Welcome to this second podcast to talk about The Spectator's Economic Disruptor of the Year Awards, sponsored by Julius Baer, the private bank. I'm Martin van der Weer. I'm the business editor of The Spectator and its Any Other Business columnist. With me, I have Martin Cuthbert, who is the head of the Northeast region for Julius Baer, and Gordon Black, distinguished West Yorkshire businessman, who I'll introduce in more detail in a moment. I'm going to start with Martin Cuthbert. We're sitting in his offices in Leeds in a building called Platform, a very high-tech building built almost literally on the platform of Leeds Station with a view across urban Leeds from the window. And I'm just going to ask Martin, first of all, to introduce the Julius Baer business in Leeds and how it connects to the community of entrepreneurs and innovators in this region. Martin.
Thank you, Martin. Julius Baer was originally a family business that was taken into the public sector a number of years ago. And it's always been an entrepreneurial business. We are a business that's solely focused around one activity, which is the management of our private clients' affairs. And this has meant that we need to be entrepreneurial in spirit and nature in the way that we go about our business. And the entrepreneurial marketplace is one that we see that we have a natural synergy with and believe that we, with the knowledge we have, the history we have, we can help those people in developing their future plans. So we're excited to be working with The Spectator around this, the Disruptor Awards, as we feel it's a natural fit for us, for our clients' marketplace and our business.
Great, thank you very much. So turning to our guest, Gordon Black. Gordon's family company was Peter Black Holdings, which was founded by his father, who was an immigrant, like many successful business people in this country. And it became a major supplier of footwear, toiletries, cosmetics, vitamin pills, all sorts of things to some of the UK's leading retailers, notably Marks and Spencer. And the business was eventually sold off to a Hong Kong-based trading company, Li and Fung, and Gordon's family office now is involved in investing in some other businesses in this region. So he has had a long career. He joined the family firm back in 1965. Gordon, you've had a very long career in the West Yorkshire business scene. So the first question I want to ask you is this whole idea of disruptors. It seems relatively new. It's become very fashionable. But do you think of your own business as having been a disruptor in its day? I mean, back in the 50s or 60s, what were you doing that was disruptive then?
Well, it's a strong word, disruptor. I think it's really, it signifies the ability to break the mold and sort of challenge conventional thinking. And I came from a background where my parents in Germany were very wealthy. They lost everything, came here and started again. And so we were too insecure to be complacent in a way. And I think one always has to challenge oneself if one's business is ripe for the time. And I think the ability, one of the main characteristics, and in retrospect we probably had this, is the ability to react positively to changes in society and business and see the changes as an opportunity rather than a threat. And we had a roller coaster time, and we made more good decisions than bad, but only just. And I think one of the most important characteristics for a successful businessman today is not to be arrogant, you know, is to be positive, try things, but back off if it doesn't win.
One has the impression today of business circumstances changing very, very rapidly, so that the reaction time has to be quicker and quicker for the entrepreneur and the businessman. Or do you think that's a bit of an illusion, as it were? Were you constantly reacting to change in your business days?
Well, classically in this area, this was a textile area. And many of my friends used to say to me, isn't it unfair, my grandfather had a weaving business, my father had a weaving business, we're in textiles, we're not busy, isn't it unfair? And really no one has a divine right. The IT revolution, the pace of change seems to have quickened. And traditional textile businesses in this part of the world, very few have survived. I think one of the main points is that we had this fairly cosmopolitan upbringing, And we appreciated fairly on that the global economy was a reality. And one had to think, one couldn't live in a cocoon in this country. One had to have the ability to think wider, really.
Was that around export business or more around the production side that you could see there was value in producing on a global basis?
Well, I think that people saw China and the Far East as slave labour and poor working conditions. That really wasn't the case. With labour-intensive products like footwear, bags, luggage, we moved that overseas and we worked with factories in Asia, which had very high standards. We made sure that they realised that good working conditions were enlightened self-interest, and that if they had good lighting, the quality would be better. If they looked after their people, they'd attract the best people to work for them. And so it was wrong to think that it was just for labour reasons. The level of capital investment in many of the factories in Asia was much higher than here. So we believed very much in a concept of centres of excellence. Asia, different parts of it, were centres of excellence for labour-intensive products. But we went into toiletries and cosmetics, where it was a capital-intensive business, where you invested in machinery and the labour part of it was very small. So I think one had to look at it realistically on that basis.
And you were quite early into that business of outsourcing.
Yeah, well, it was very...
Was it painful? I mean, did that involve factory closures?
Well, there were
in
factory
West
closures.
Or elsewhere and, in Britain.
You know, we were influenced by Marks and Spencer's. We really tried to create a family environment. Although we were big, we weren't unionised because we had the best possible relationship with our employees. But imports created jobs. You know, we had a design centre here. We had to handle all the logistics and the marketing and the whole quality control issue. So not as many jobs were as eliminated as one might think when one imports. Imports also create jobs. I mean, where we were lucky, luck's a big word, but you make your own luck to a degree. But timing is vitally important. Now, I read history at university, which my father said was as close to footwear as he could find. But a very important saying for us was from Victor Hugo, which was, for me, and I often think of it, is greater than the sword is the idea whose time has come. Mm. And that really was a maxim we had in front of us a lot of the time. But where we were lucky is that Marks and Spencer's traditionally were in clothing and food. And we persuaded them to accelerate into other areas, footwear, toiletries, cosmetics. And they were of a size where immediately you had a success, scale was... And scale is very important. There are many businesses. When I look at businesses, one of the sort of boxes that's got to be ticked, it's got to be scalable.
Hmm. Before we move on to the entries for the awards from the Northeast region, two things about your life story strike me as quite disruptive in the retail area. One was you were a very early player in the idea of factory shops, factory outlets. Secondly, one of your later business investments was television shopping, which had a huge success. Just briefly sketch those two things in for
us.
Yeah,
well, we were always influenced. I'm an Americanophile. I love the American approach where the only aristocracy is success. And, you know, my first visit to the States, I went up the Hudson River and I saw the Statue of Liberty, and it really made an impression on me. And in our world, everything comes from the States, really. The supermarket, the shopping mall. And we saw factory shops in the States. We started a chain of factory shops. We also saw outlet shopping centres. The biggest one is in Freeport in Maine. And at the time, we owned Hornsey Pottery on the East Coast, which is about as isolated in this country as Maine is in the States. And we started the first outlet shopping centre, and that went on, and that's become a big part of the retail experience in this country. So therefore, it was a natural when we were approached by someone who'd lived in the States and wanted to start a shopping channel, we could see it. And the success of High Street TV, and it was an amazing success, we exited a few years ago. The turnover went from nothing to 70 million in 6.5 years. Because we attacked every route to market. We had shopping channels, five of them. We bought 100 hours media on other channels every day. We had a very good website. We sold to over 7,000 retail outlets. And there was synergy between the two because on television, we said also available at John Lewis or wherever. And in the stores, it said as seen on television. And we sold off the page in newspapers. Now, we're all reading about the demise of the high street. And I think pendulums overswing. It's not the end of the high street. But the world of Amazon is a real reality. I mean, where I live, all the little roads are blocked with white vans delivering for Amazon now. Mm. We never knew when we had a winning product like the Nutribullet whether people saw it on television or on the internet and went to John Lewis to buy it, or they saw it on John Lewis and went home. So I think the answer is, in this present turmoil, is that retailers and people selling products must try and cover all routes to market.
Well, good. Thank you very much for that. Let's move on and talk about the entries for the Disruptor Awards. So we had a very, very large number of entries. In total, we had something of a bias in the weighting towards London and the South East, as you might expect, because that's where innovators and venture capitalists and incubators and all of that stuff is more concentrated. But we had a very interesting selection from the north of England and from Northern Ireland and Scotland. And we're going on to do podcasts from the other regions. Today, we're talking about the Northeast entry. Out of the very interesting selection, we had to leave one or two out that we would like to have included. A fascinating business in the bioscience area based in Newcastle called Quantum DX, for example, which is doing handheld diagnostic devices. But they agreed with me that they're not at the commercialization stage. They might be by next year, so we hope they'll enter again. We had another interesting entry from the Leeds area, which is basically gym clubs, fitness clubs for everyone at a cheaper price. It looked great, but it probably wasn't a unique business. So when we had to make a cut, we had to leave that one out too. But we picked three. And what I'm going to ask is for Martin Cuthbert, perhaps, to just give us a brief description of each of the three, and then Gordon and I might comment. So we're going to start with one in the legal services area, which is called Radar.
So Radar are an interesting business. They happen to be in this building with us as well, which is an interesting place to be that you mentioned earlier. So the professional services community in Leeds and Yorkshire is very, very strong. I think we mentioned earlier it's the second largest base in the country as far as professional services is concerned. Radar are a very different business. Their entry point is to make for smaller businesses access to legal assistance simple to enter into via the portal that they have and the web-based material that people can access. And then as they go through that, they can then find themselves, if they require legal advice, assistance and a proper program, then pass through into what we consider the more conventional channels. So it's a different business. I can see it very much as a disruptor. And it will be interesting to see how that business develops for them when some of those smaller businesses that they bring in through their portal start to become those bigger PLCs, and whether they can retain those and whether they really cause some disruption in the marketplace for the other big players.
Your legal bills, if you're a small company, a startup company, the cost of the legalities, and particularly if you venture into any area that's a regulated sort of business where you need extra professional advice and so on, can be enormous. So the idea of using digital tools to simplify the access to answers to legal questions seemed to me a very good one. Gordon, did you...
I think this is a very interesting business. I welcome having a high regard for lawyers, but I've also spent a lot of money with them over the years. And I really welcome a challenge to the traditional world of lawyers. I think this is a business very much in the right place at the right time. And they also, it appears, they've got to first base. Mm. They already have a certain good level of scale. And I think this is a most interesting business.
Mm. They're also tapping into the insurance side of the market as well. So they're obviously providing services into insurance companies around some of their ancillary services. So they've got a really good dispersion in their business around the different sort of offerings that they have. The interesting piece will be for me in 5 years' time, when some of those entrants they've had have got bigger, where do they take them and do they retain them? And that'll be the interesting, I think, and that'll be the real disruptor if they retain some of those bigger businesses.
Good. So in our semi-finalist list, which are 22 names, the legal services, we kind of put that alongside fintech. So we've got a couple of very exciting fintech names, Revolut and Pocket. We've also got one in the prop tech. That's where kind of real estate meets digital technologies. We've got one called Movem. So I think we've got the whole sort of professional financial sector well covered. Our next one from the Northeast, again, it's actually it's a Leeds-based business, is Surface Skins. And here we can make a distinction between, I made a distinction between, as it were, boffin disruptors and sort of brilliant lateral thinking disruptors. You don't have to have an invention to be a disruptor. You just have to have a way of bringing a product to market easier and cheaper and in a friendlier way and so on. But sometimes there's just an invention, and this one is an invention. Martin, just give us a brief description of that.
Yeah, so simplicity is the beauty of this, really, and it just seems so obvious, really, but they've created a pad for doors, particularly entranceway doors into things such as hospitals, can be used for catering services, food manufacturing, and it is a clean pad. So you press the door, it disperses some sort of chemical, I'm supposed to be an expert, which cleans your hand and takes away any bacteria. So the flow through of people touching the doors, which has been obviously a historic issue in the last 10, 15 years, particularly in hospitals, is removed. It just seems so simple and obvious, but clearly it wasn't. But somebody has found out how to make it effective.
Seems amazing. No one thought of that before, doesn't it, Gordon?
Yeah. Infection is a big issue. This is a business very relevant to today's needs. I don't know if it's patented and it's protected, to what extent, but it's a more difficult business to achieve scale. I think this is a more difficult business to get to first base than some others because it is a good product, but it'll take a bit of selling.
Mm. And I'm not sure about cost-wise, particularly, you know, the level of cost that's involved in it. And that's always, as you refer to, is one of the key measures in any business. So, again, very simple. Yeah, very straightforward.
But its appeal to us was a simple, brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Why didn't somebody think of that?
About before, yes,
you would say, immediately.
The interesting part about this, Gordon, is obviously it's come out of the university hospital background, which is something that we are seeing more of. You have that historic Cambridge effect, which is they seem to have in Cambridge the market monopoly around great ideas and thinking and entrepreneurial thinking. And that's definitely flooding out into other major cities now. And we're seeing that in the north where the universities are very much more engaged with the marketplace. And it was good to see that.
I think to get the message across, they need to spend some time with good PR because it needs to capture people's imagination very much. Yeah. And I think a box which I like to see ticked is an international dimension that you can sell overseas. And this could be enormous if there's nothing similar in the States or wherever.
Yeah, good. And the third one is in the automotive sector. And Martin Cuthbert, I know you're a petrol head. So just describe this one to us. It's called Zero Light.
So Zero Light have taken on further, and I could probably sit for hours and play around with this. So I'm probably quite biased in that I really do like this. What they've done is they've taken the 3D media packages that you can actually build cars, your car online and have a look at a car when you're thinking of purchasing and putting the extras on, etc. They've taken that to a new level. So the graphics and the visualization that you see is extraordinary. But they've flipped it over into the dealer side as well now. So not only is it something online for the consumer to look at, the dealer can participate in this in the showroom and build a car together with the client in the showroom, but also they can show the myriad of different derivatives and models that are available now very simply and very quickly. And it really is quite impressive when you see it, the use of graphics and the ability to store all this information in a cloud, etc., to make it very simple so it doesn't soak up lots of bandwidth in anybody's systems.
Gordon, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it's a big market, this, and they've already got to first base. They've achieved a turnover of over 4 million. I think it's a competitive area, and I don't know how easily it can be copied, but it's an area where there's a lot of invention going on, a lot of new thinking, and this seems to, again, be the right business at the right time.
Mm. They're scaled up. They seem to have plenty of staff and people sort of actively in it. You're right. There are, I don't think there are any patents attached to this. So I think it is probably a race to be ahead of the curve on the technology side.
It never worried us if we had competition, as long as you're a lap ahead of the competition. Yeah. And it would appear that they probably are a lap ahead,
in motoring
terms, ahead of the competition.
Yeah. And I say, if you get the right market and people like me who will spend lots of time fiddling around, then it can be a useful tool.
And this one sits, in terms of sectors, in our list of 22, this one sits alongside another entrant called Car Wow, which is quite heavily advertised on television now, which is a fundamentally a comparison site, I think, but it's a route into buying a car from mainstream dealers, where you basically choose your dealership and get a better price and so on. So the whole area.
I've used Car Wow, my daughter's car, it's very interesting. It's very intuitive, and they come back to you. They're very smart, so they keep updating you. Even beyond that sales, they let you know what's happening, and then sort of other variations. So it's good. They're always at the back. I mean, obviously, you can stop it with the new sort of data protection rules, but if you're open to it, it's very clever the way that they market to you.
Yeah, I think the traditional garage is being challenged, and Tesla are big. In the States, they have a shop in a shopping mall, basically, and that's a sign of what's to come.
Yeah. I occasionally write in my column items about the motor trade and the car industry, where I quote a real person who I never name, and he's my man on the forecourt in a trilby and a British warm overcoat. but I think his days are numbered.
Yeah.
Technology is taking over, as in everything else. Anyway, I think that's a very good summary of our three Northeastern semi-finalists. So thank you very much for doing that. I wanted to come back to Gordon just a bit more to talk about the general business scene in the region, particularly in West Yorkshire, whether you see any particular trends in which kinds of businesses are now coming to the fore, whereas once it was, of course, the textile sector predominantly, but other manufacturing like yours too, what you see happening now. And also the point that I know you like to make about the ethos of business that's being lost or you would like to hold on to. So feel free to make some final remarks on all that.
Well, I've always found it a big advantage to come from Yorkshire. In the South, they expect us to be call a spade a spade. I think there are defining characteristics of a Yorkshireman, and I think tenacity and determination. In the area, it amazes me that by the number of people who are employed in textiles, and I ask myself, what are they doing now? I think we've been to the forefront in the IT world. There are several examples. I think Yorkshire has shown its ability to reinvent itself in the face of changes probably better than other areas. And that's down possibly to the characteristics of a Yorkshireman. But it's such a widespread diversity of different industries that have emerged, a lot of them in the service sector. But it's difficult to pinpoint specific industries, but it seems to be a wide range of activity which has replaced the traditional areas. And that's partly down, I think, to the attraction of living in the area. We've attracted a lot of people to come to Yorkshire to live here. And once they come here, they certainly don't want to leave.
Quite right, quite right. Before we conclude with Gordon, let me fit in, for the benefit of our podcast listeners, a quick plug for his book called From Bags to Blenders, which contains his history and philosophy of business. But I'm going to finish with Martin Cuthbert again. And I want to ask you about availability of capital for entrepreneurs in this region. I mean, is there enough? Does it matter? Can they simply get on the fast train we could see out the window if it's running this morning and go to London and find the capital they need? Is there a sort of cluster of venture capitalists and fine bankers like yourself who are, you know, sorting that problem out? Or is it a problem?
Well, I think it's always a problem, isn't it? And particularly at the seed stage, I think for people to get investment is a challenge. I think it's improving. We touched on this morning when we were talking off air. The market is very much still, I think, strong in London for that type of investment. It's coming up into the area. I think there are more people actually who have been in business themselves, such as Gordon in the past, who now actually look to sort of invest as a seed investor, a capital investor. So I think there's a lot more private money, angel type investors, and a lot more availability around that. I think that we will see a significant growth. There are some specific funds that have moved up into the Northeast now and making capital available. So there is growth there, but there could always be more to help this Northern powerhouse that we keep talking about.
Good. Well, we'll conclude there. We're moving on to Edinburgh next in the next few days, and then in due course to Manchester and Birmingham. But very many thanks to Gordon Black and Martin Cuthbert for such an interesting conversation this morning. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.